Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Pretty.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. We had sunshine today.
Yes, we did.
It was cold.
Not too bad.
Well, I walked my dogs today and I got cold, really cold. And then I saw three huge deer. This was at like noon, just hanging out in somebody's yard. I don't know what they were doing, but actually the dogs started like pulling on the leash and I looked over and there were the deer and the one started to walk toward me and I'm like, that's not a good idea. Go away. But anyway, hey, I made my TV debut this week.
So I hear.
Yes, indeed. Got a call. Actually, I got an email from one of my yoga students who is also the program manager or director at Channel 3, WKYC, our NBC affiliate here in Cleveland. And she says, hey, are you covering the Lance Armstrong story? And I had to admit that, yes, I was. She said, well, somebody wants to come out and interview you. And I'm like 5 or 6 minutes into that interview. And then the guy interviewing me, Dick Russ, says, why don't you come down to the station and come on the news show tonight? So then I went down to the station and went on the news show that night. And, of course, I've gotten a gazillion emails and, oh, look, you were on TV. And it's like, oh, it was unbelievable. So what a disappointment the interview between Oprah and Lance was. Did you watch?
I skimmed. I couldn't bring myself to marinate in it for too long.
You didn't have to. It was over in the first 3 seconds.
Yeah. I saw bits and pieces of that, and I skipped through the Anderson Cooper thing on CNN afterwards and saw a bit of that.
Well, with Betsy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought her interview was much more compelling than Lance Armstrong's. And I have to tell you, my eyes and brains are so exhausted. I am just exhausted from... You know, you have to read everything and listen to everything. It was crazy. But my favorite post about the Lance Armstrong saga so far is a photo of a guy wearing a T-shirt that says, Betsy was right. You know, it's this dark blue T-shirt with big white letters. And I just had to laugh at that because she was right. And unfortunately, she was not vindicated. So our guest for discussion of the momentous occasion is Neil Brown. Neil has a lot of really cool credentials, but I think the two that might be most memorable are being called a complete douchebag on Twitter by Lance Armstrong, and I'm sure he'll tell us how that happened. Unfortunately, that led to his dismissal as a reporter for Versus. So I want to know how that came about when he didn't institute the Twitter. I don't know. Twitter, you know how that goes. He was also named one of the top Twitter accounts to follow for cycling geeks by Outside Magazine. I don't know how you could beat those. He's also a writer for quite a few publications. He's a cycling analyst as opposed to a psychoanalyst, which is maybe what Mr. Armstrong needs. Given his previous commentary and his awesome series of fashion tips with Jonathan Vauders videos, they're hilarious. I couldn't think of anyone who might be more interesting to help deconstruct the Oprah and Lance interview. And then I promise we're going to, after the news, we are going to have a break from Lance. It's time. Our guest in the second half of the show is Mike Wilson. He's the bicycle and pedestrian coordinator for MetroPlan Orlando, which is the regional transportation planning agency. He serves as the board president of the Florida Bicycle Association, which is the statewide bicyclist education and advocacy organization. He's currently working on a project called IamTraffic.org, which I think is such a cool name. IamTraffic's vision says the drivers of human-powered vehicles are expected and respected as a normal part of traffic. I think that's pretty cool. Next month, IamTraffic is hosting an event to launch their new organization. He'll tell us about that and along with what our friend Carrie Caffrey's Cycling Savvy is up to these days. So whether you found the Lance thing interesting or not, I think you'll appreciate and enjoy Neil Brown's take on the entire gooey mess. So, Neil, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So before we jump into and onto the Oprah interview, I'd like to give our listeners a little bit of background about you and your work. Tell me and our listeners how you got into cycling and then into the cycling journalism gig.
Got into cycling through my father. He's Irish. My parents are, my mom's British, my dad's Irish, and he was a bike racer, professional bike racer. Not a well known one, not even a probably a very good one, to be perfectly honest. But he raced a little bit in Ireland, England, a little bit in Europe, and when my parents immigrated to the States, my dad had cycling stories, and it just seemed these fantastic stories of racing and riding and adventures. And so I've been racing a bike since I was like 16, 15 or 16.
And now you're like 25, right?
Now I'm like 18 or 19.
Got it.
I'm 40.
You don't have to. I didn't care how old you are. I was just pulling your leg there, or as we say, yanking your chain.
I have journalistic truth here.
Well, at least somebody does. Never mind. So tell us about the tweet that got you into so much trouble with Lance Armstrong and then what happened because of it.
What happened was I have an iPhone app, and I said, and Lance Armstrong blocks basically almost all journalists. And I just tweeted, find out why Lance Armstrong blocked me, download my app. And he responded within 30 seconds, because you're a douchebag.
And
and so I'm not going to take that. I don't have any Lance Armstrong and all these cyclists. They don't sit on a pedestal with me. They're just people. So I went back at him. And because this is Twitter and both of us have a numerous followers, you know, Lance has over 3 million. I don't have nowhere near that, but mine's well in the thousands. And it just rolled and rolled. And it was almost like I described it as a middle school playground fight. And after several hours, it finally just died down. And at the time, I was writing for Versus, which at the time was the only station TV station that broadcasted bike racing.
That's right.
Next day, they called me up and said, "Hey, douchebag, what's going on?" And I knew right then and there that I was in trouble. And they said, "Well, we're going to have meetings and discuss this," because they, quite frankly, they were afraid of losing access to Lance. And I found out later that someone in Lance's camp had made a phone call and it advised them to get rid of me. And a couple days later, they let me go.
So another casualty of the Lance Armstrong strong arm system.
Yeah, very minor. I tell the story, and I tell it with a kind of a bit of smile on my face, because compared to some things he's done to like Betsy Andreu, other journalists where he sued them, Emma O'Reilly.
This was pretty small relative to that. You're right.
The only thing I found out recently, though, was he tried to intimidate a guest that I was going to have on my podcast. And he told that guest that he wanted to punch me in the throat. So I take that as a compliment.
Well, it's too bad you can't somehow frame that one and put it up on your wall, you know? Oh, well. So I guess we're going to move on to the interview. What do you think?
It was what we were expected it to be. Lance admitting to doping. It had already been leaked. The interview was already pre-recorded on Monday. By Monday night, Tuesday morning, it had already been leaked what he had said. Not verbatim, but yes, that he admitted to doping. What was disappointing, though, was the lack of details and also his smug attitude. He never seemed to give – he never gave contrition. It was never a heartfelt apology in anything of his statements. And at times, he smirked and smiled about how he called referring to Betsy Andreu, "I called you crazy. I called you a bitch, but I never called you fat."
I know. I mean, it sounds funny now, but it was such a stupid thing to say. "I never called you fat." Really? That's what you came on the Oprah show to talk about? It was really hard. Do you think she asked the hard questions?
I think she did in the beginning. What drugs did you take?
Right.
Did you take or I want a yes or no answer. And Lance obliged her. And she tried her best with like the controversial like what happened in the hospital room, where really was for Betsy Andreu and for a lot of people is ground zero for this whole scandal.
Right.
And he dodged it and said, I don't want to talk about this right now. I had a private conversation with Betsy and I'm leaving it at that. And when Betsy Andreu went on CNN, she was very upset about Lance's response to that question, saying that, she owed him more than that. And I agree. I think, and Oprah backed off, said, "Okay, And for someone who built this as a no-holds-barred interview, she didn't push him on that. You know, a true journalist would have pushed back on that, or could have even had a real journalist too could have had the guts and say, you know what, then Lance, this interview is over. You agreed to no holds barred. You're going to answer all my questions interview. If you can't answer that, interview over.
But I think that would have been great, but it didn't happen. She just sort of glanced over it and moved on. But, you know, there was a lot of chatter today. In fact, there was chatter all day. And every columnist, every blogger, everybody in our industry, in the bike world, went exactly to that point, that in no way was Lance willing to say that Betsy had told the truth all along. And Betsy was totally vindicated. Everybody knows she was not telling any lies, that she was telling the truth. It was unbelievable. Best thing I saw today was a T-shirt that said Betsy was right. I don't know if you saw that on Facebook. It was funny. Some guy wearing a shirt that says Betsy was right all along. At any rate, what do you think the most damning thing Lance Armstrong said yesterday?
It all happened in those first 2 minutes that he admitted to doping during his professional cycling career. And then from there, like we just discussed, it just kind of went downhill a little bit for me. There was nothing like really shocked me a whole lot. I read Tyler Hamilton's book, The Secret Race.
Right.
And who's followed professional racing all my adult life and reported on it for many years. I was still, and not naive to doping the professional ranks, I was still shocked by what Tyler did. And we didn't have any of those admissions during the interview. There was no like, well, there was a time in the Alps when we pulled the bus over and we all doped up. It was more of just, yeah, I doped. And that's as far as we're going to get with Lance at this point.
Did you notice his tell, his sort of when he was going to lie, he looked away and kind of shook his foot? You know, a bunch of us, and you were tweeting last night, and I was listening to some of the, or watching some of the stuff coming up on screen, and that's what people were saying, that, oh, that one's a lie, oh, that one's a lie.
He has some definite tells, and one I thought was real obvious was he kept pulling on his lip. But that said, though, I've gone back and looked at some videotape of his saying, I never doped, and he looks the person right in the eye and says that without blinking, without moving his eyes, without brushing, you know, some of these weird telltale signs we do, like brushing our hair, maybe subconsciously scratching the back of our neck during a lie. He looks that person right in the eye and says, I never doped, and doesn't blink. And I truly think that to a certain degree, Armstrong has some sociopathic tendencies.
He's had a lot of sort of psychological deconstruction today online, including things like narcissistic, sociopathic. I would agree. He could look you straight in the eye and tell a lie. In fact, I thought some of the things that Oprah did in terms of sort of interspersing different things that had gone on, and even some of the things Tyler said into the interview, I thought she did her homework. You know, but he just sort of deflected everything.
Yeah, yeah. In Oprah's defense, she did do her homework. She read the books that are kind of the tell-all books that are out right now, The Seven Deadly Sins by David Walsh, and like I just mentioned, Tyler Hamilton's book, The Secret Race.
Right.
She claims to have read the 1,000-page USADA document that really gets into the nitty-gritty of the doping and the intimidation. Anyone who's still a Lance Armstrong fan and thinks that Lance is a good guy, you really need to read these writers' affidavits. It just really brings home the fact that he was a mafia kingpin. I've used that phrase several times in different interviews in my own writing, but he truly was. There's a startling similarity between a mafia kingpin and Lance Armstrong. He decided who raced, who didn't race, if your career continued or it died.
Yep, the Don. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Neil Brown. Neil writes a great blog, neilbrown.com, and it's with an E, by the way, B-R-O-W-N-E, but we'll get that at the end of the interview for sure. So do you think anything's really going to change? I didn't hear what I wanted to hear about implicating Hein Verbruggen or Pat McQuaid. I didn't hear any of the things that might actually make a change. Do you think there's going to be anything changing?
You know, those two characters, Hein Verbruggen and Pat McQuaid, are current and past presidents of the UCI, the governing body of cycling. I don't see them falling because of Armstrong's admittance last night. Armstrong has said he's not going to name names. Both those people came out with press statements today saying, relieved that Lance Armstrong came out and admitted the doping, and it proves that we were not part of it.
Yeah, right.
For a second. But where I do see change, and I see change that's already happened, is the culture of professional cycling. Back in the 90s, early 2000s, that was the culture of cycling. As anyone who follows professional racing knows, you can look back at the Tour de France, and you sometimes have to go back to like 8th place, 9th place, to find someone who isn't tainted by doping in some regards. But now I don't think that doping is so endemic. And by that I mean, I don't think the postal team, it was systematic, it was part of the team. You doped or you lost your job. Yes, there's still going to be doping in cycling. Yes, there's still going to be doping in football, baseball, track and field, everything. But I just don't see it being as systematic and run by the team like it does in the postal days. I see it more as like guys that are desperate for results that feel like this is the only way that they're going to win a race or keep their job, and they need the dope to do it.
So if you were a dad with a kid who said, "Dad, I want to race my bike," would you be worried about that?
I would be worried about him getting into any kind of professional sport, not cycling in particular. Being a professional athlete, we tend to put them on a pedestal, and they tend to live their lives like they were a god, where rules and situations don't apply to them, and then there is no consequences. That would be my only worry, concern, because they do think they can just walk among us and not suffer the consequence. And we see that all the time. You know, not only in cycling, but in football and baseball and basketball. These guys do just crazy things, and we all shake our heads, go, gosh, these guys are given a God-given talent to hit a ball, to shoot a ball, to do whatever, and they squander it by getting arrested at 3 o'clock in the morning because they were drunk and hit someone at a strip bar.
Yeah, that's true. That's all true. So
that would be my main concern.
Well, so what do you think will be the next chapter in the Lance Armstrong saga? You know, the next thing. What's going to happen from here, just from your perspective?
I don't think Lance can rest and say, oh, well, I did Oprah, I'm done. He's going to have to go, whenever he comes up in public somewhere, a real journalist is going to ask him those hard-hitting questions, and is not going to shrink away. Because Lance is doing this for one reason, for redemption, and to get it back into the public eye. And he needs to go the whole way. He can't go this half-hearted truth. I did an interview with Pat O'Brien, who is a well-known sports announcer. And some people may not remember, but about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and he brought this up himself during my interview with him, that, you know, he got drunk or was high and left a voicemail on an intern or some lady's voicemail about how he wanted to snort coke off her naked body and let's get high. And so he says, and he said, you know, my advice I would give to Lance Armstrong is you go all the way. You have to fully confess and put it behind you, because then you can just say, well, I've already talked about this, I'm not going to talk about it anymore. But Lance hasn't done that. He hasn't fully confessed, and he's going to leave himself open to a lot more questioning wherever he goes. And he's not going to be able to get what he seeks the most, and that is a little bit of sympathy and being able to return to professional sports in some capacity. You know, going on Oprah doesn't count as a legal admittance to anything. He still needs to go in front of USADA and admit to what he's done.
Well, it will be interesting, although it is a little overwhelming. It is the story of the week. It'll probably be the story of the next few weeks for the cycling world. It would be nice to have something else happen, but I really appreciate you joining me on the Outspoken Cyclist, and we'll catch up again when the next chapter opens or closes on the saga. How's that?
My pleasure.
Thanks. All right, Neil. Bye-bye.
Neil Brown joined us from Greenville, South Carolina, where he is the proprietor of neilbrown.com.
How about that, getting canned for Lance Armstrong calling him a douchebag? I can't quite wrap my mind around that, but
that's not surprising, and that's part of the reason why this sort of activity is allowed to go on, not just in cycling, but in sports, in politics, anywhere you can name. Because journalists know that if they dig too deep and they get too close to ugly truth, they will lose their access to the people that they need to be sources for their stories.
Well, that's true.
And that's why there's no investigative journalism going on in the United States, at least these days, is because the politicians, the sports figures, everybody, they control who has access to them from the press. And if you write something bad about me, then that'll be the last time that you get any sort of access to me or my people or anything like that. And so that doesn't surprise me at all that he got booted from Versus, because Versus knew that they'd never get another interview with Lance if they didn't cut this guy loose.
Wow. Isn't that sad, though? I mean, what happened to the free press? What happened to freedom of speech and being able to talk to people and report the news?
It's gotten a little bit upside down. You still have a free press. You can write anything you want. There are just consequences.
Right.
And there's no one holding those people accountable for doing what they're doing.
That's true.
In terms of I'm talking about the people in power, not the press people.
Yeah, sure.
It's a very sad situation.
It is indeed. And were you at his blog? Did you take a look?
I did not get a chance to take a look.
He's got some. I like the way he's got it set up. Each story is sort of a block. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting, the stories he's reported on. He actually took a screenshot of Lance Armstrong tweeting.
Tweet.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that Lance Armstrong usually blocks journalists. And so it must have been that tiny little window of opportunity that started the poop storm, as we say. So
we taking a break?
We could take a break.
All right. Let's take a break. And then you said you have news.
I do have news. Some really kind of good news this week.
I might have a few items to throw in there, too, if you...
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, we'll get to the news and much more right after this short break on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Oh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And before we get to the news, let's
mention
very briefly that in less than a month, it's come around again, time for WJCU's annual Radiothon, in something we do every February to raise awareness and, more importantly, financial support to keep the station here running for another year. This year's Radiothon will be from Friday, February 8th. Through Sunday, February 17th, so that means that you get to hear from us twice this year, on Saturday the 9th of February and Saturday the 16th of February. So more details in the coming weeks. Just wanted to give you a quick heads up, and hopefully you will be generous, open up your wallet or your credit card as you have in the past, and support The Outspoken Cyclist and support WJCU.
Excellent. Most excellent. More most excellent. Time for some news.
Okay.
All right. This, to me, is probably the best bicycle story of the year. It happens to be the 2012 end-of-the-year bicycle story. But two young brothers were named the 2012 Sports Illustrated Kids Sports Kids of the Year at a huge banquet in their honor in New York City. Connor 8 and Caden 6, Long is their last name, were part of the Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year ceremony that recognized people like LeBron James, celebrities such as Jay-Z and Beyonce, and Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski. Everyone there, though, was impressed by Connor and Caden's accomplishments. Listen to this. Caden suffers from cerebral palsy, but Connor doesn't let that stop him from playing sports with his brother. The two compete in triathlons together, with Connor towing Caden behind in a raft during the swimming leg, towing him behind his bike during the cycling portion, and pushing him in a stroller during the run. Triathlons have been a great way for the brothers to come together and have made them an inspiration to everyone who hears their story. After hearing the story at the sportsman ceremony, Coach K said that Connor and Caden have scholarships to Duke waiting for them when they get older.
Hmm.
LeBron said that the brothers should get ready for the private plane that's going to take them from their home in Tennessee to Miami to, quote, meet the guys. Even Jay-Z and Beyonce couldn't wait to shake their hands with Connor and Caden. Their parents great this week. So I looked at this and found all of the information on it. And you've got to go out and take a look at some of the videos of this 8-year-old kid and this young brother sitting in either the raft or the trailer or in the stroller, just grinning from ear to ear. They said this kid would never do anything, and he's doing some wonderful things. He's starting to talk a little. He's starting to emote a little. You could see he just loves being with his brother, just loves it. So their parents gratefully and graciously thanked everyone who contacted the boys and via their Facebook page this week, said they're going to try to answer all the messages. I can't even imagine how many messages that have been sent to them. This young 8-year-old was interviewed by a whole bunch of people. He just has an unbelievable he sounds like he might be 25, except for his tiny little voice. You know, he's just a remarkable young man. They came in dead last in this long triathlon, dead last. And somebody said they'd send a coach along, by the way, to run alongside of him and to swim with him and ride with him just to make sure that he's safe. But he's like, I don't care if I come in last. He says, I get to be with my brother. It's just amazing. All you have to do is type in Connor and Caden. You don't even need their last name, and the whole thing will come up. It's awesome. Really awesome. Have you ever traveled with your bike?
Only by car.
Aha. Have you ever wanted to fly with your bike?
Yeah, it seems like a hassle and probably kind of expensive.
Well, funny you should say that. Sonia Looney published a nice piece in Bicycling Magazine about the bicycle-friendly airlines that she's found when she's wanted to travel. Evidently, she lives in Denver. And two of the 6 or 7 airlines she mentions in her piece, and it's in this month's Bicycling. It was up online this week. Are Frontier and Southwest. She says that they are the lower fare carriers, that they are much nicer to bicycle flight, and that they include a bike sort of as check baggage at a much reduced rate from what you might expect, you know, traveling other ways. I know we ship bikes and it's very expensive. And some of the things she explained about Frontier and Southwest made it interesting enough that I would consider taking my bike that way. You know, people really want their bikes with them. They don't always like to ship them because sometimes they don't show up. You know how luggage is. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty nice. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I know a lot of people like to travel with their bike. This is just the weirdest story ever. It's sad. You might remember about 6 months ago, one of our bright stars, Leslie Boehm, succumbed to brain cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? Okay. And his original partner in his company, Eclipse, the one that made the bicycle luggage that started off his career, was named Sean Jackson. This is unbelievable. Sean Jackson was killed in a plane crash in Florida this week. This comes from Brain, bicycle retailer and industry news on January 16th. Sean Jackson, a former bike industry designer who co-founded the Eclipse company in the 70s, died Tuesday after being injured in a small plane crash here on Sunday. This is in Sarasota. The private plane's pilot was killed immediately after the plane crashed onto the new College of Florida campus soon after takeoff. Jackson, who was 63, suffered severe burns and died Tuesday, according to AnnArbor.com. He was from Michigan. He's also a professor in the School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He co-founded Eclipse with Leslie Boehm. Eclipse made bike touring accessories, including panniers, and also had a line of motorcycle soft luggage. After leaving Eclipse, Jackson started his own design firm, Sean Jackson Design. According to his university bio, Jackson holds more than 50 patents and has received national and international honors, including the prestigious IDEA Award from Business Week. His firm, John Jackson Design, serves clients such as Apple, Dell, Toshiba, General Electric Medical Systems, Herman Miller, Nike, L.L. Bean, Eddie Bauer, Harley-Davidson, and Patagonia. talk about some big names.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson was in the bike industry when a handful of U.S. brands, including Blackburn, Road Gear, Specialized, Cannondale, Hind, and Eclipse, were bringing a new level of design and marketing to the industry. Remembers former Eclipse employee Mark Graff. We had spirited but friendly competition, said Graff, now with Smart E-Tailing. Specialized founder and president Mike Sinyard recalled Jackson as being at the center of that community. So very sad. Lost to the whole design community in mm-hmm, bicycles mm-hmm. and obviously to some big companies. Yeah, he was a bright star, I'll tell you. Speaking of designers, this is from the Wall Street Journal on January 17th by a J.S. Marcus. Dutch bike designer Sjoerd Smit doesn't need to ride a bike to get inspiration. He says, I get ideas anywhere. Mr. Smit is 31 years old. He's the head of design for Van Moof, an Amsterdam bike label. When I'm lying in bed or watching TV or going to an art gallery or a museum, I can get ideas. In his mind's eye, he holds on to a persistent image of the bike he is designing. The trick is to get the end product as close as possible to the dream in my head, he said. First launched in 2009, Van Moof, founded by Dutch brothers and entrepreneurs Taco and Thijs Carlier, has won a cult following from Haarlem in the Netherlands, where Mr. Smit grew up, to New York City, where Van Moof has become a hipster accessory. It offers a stylish update on a traditional city bike, some of which are called omas or grandma bikes, the main means of transportation in the flat, congested country. Unlike racing and mountain bikes, the often stodgy city bike is built for leisurely upright riding. To date, Mr. Smit has created ever-evolving versions of three main types of bikes, a single-gear men's bike with a foot brake, a seven-gear men's bike with handbrakes, and a single-gear woman's bike. Van Moof has won its share of design prizes, including Germany's Red Dot Design Award. And last year, the company sold about 10,000 bikes worldwide and is expected to sell 15,000 this year. This year, we'll also see the test launch in Asia of a small-scale bike adaptable for indoor storage. So this Mr. Sjoerd Smits is supposed to be some great designer. Great designer. So that's pretty much my news for the week.
All right. After that, I think we deserve another break, perhaps.
We can do that.
Okay. And when we come back, we're going to talk about bicycling advocacy in Florida.
We are indeed.
Stay tuned for the third half of The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Confusion ever someone or have sudden...
Have you ever had sudden confusion, trouble speaking, or understanding someone?
It could be one of the five signs of stroke.
Sudden weakness or numbness of the face, arm, or leg.
Sudden trouble with vision in one or both eyes.
Suddenly having trouble walking or difficulty with balance.
Or a sudden intense headache that comes out of nowhere.
Don't wait. Call 911 immediately.
Time lost is brain lost.
Find out more at powertoendstroke.org. Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Well, you've made it this far on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we've got one more interview for you here in the last part of the show.
We are going to talk with Mike Wilson. He is down in Orlando, Florida. Let's welcome him to the show. Mike, thanks for joining me this evening.
Glad to be here, Diane.
Finally, we get to talk to one another instead of, like, texting all the time.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to talking about the Metroplan Orlando and your role as president of the Florida Bicycle Association, but I want to get a little bit of background on you and your work. Tell us where you came from, what got you into cycling, and what you do.
Well, let's see. Let's start at the beginning. I got into cycling rather like, well, just as a kid, like everybody. I just never quit. And so, like so many people, they stop when they're 16, they get their driver's license, and then some years later after college, they pick it up. I just kept on riding. And I really started to get into just, you know, exploring my world, which was Northeast Ohio, as I mentioned to you just before we went on, that I grew up in Euclid. And so cycling has always been a huge part of my life. And then I moved to Florida in 1979, and for a number of years, I actually worked in the graphic arts business, but cycling had always been a keen interest. So So then I got involved with advocacy here in Orlando, which actually then led to my job at Metroplan Orlando, working on pedestrian and bicycle issues.
And when did that start?
1993.
Wow, so it's been a while.
Yeah, almost 20 years now that I've been working for Metroplan.
Well, what's interesting is that you've been working in bicycle advocacy for 20 years. When I start thinking about bicycle advocacy, and it's really only come into its own in the last, say, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's really gotten a lot more mainstream coverage. Absolutely.
So what kind of work are you doing at Metroplan Orlando? What is your role there?
Okay, well, Metroplan is a metropolitan planning organization for our area. That means we do the long-range plan for transportation. We prioritize the federal dollars that come to our area. And so all the local governments work through our agency, as well as our Department of Transportation, our transit agency, to do all collaborative transportation planning. And so, of course, my part is bicycle and pedestrian transportation. So that's working with all the local governments and transit agency and working across, you know, not just for planning and for facilities, but education and safety and everything that it takes to really move our community toward getting more people on foot and on bike.
So you mentioned working with federal dollars, and one of the things that comes to mind is the last transportation bill and sort of what happened to federal dollars for bike and ped programs. How has that affected your work with bicycle and pedestrian stuff in Orlando?
Well, we're having to adjust. One thing I'm very fortunate with in our area is that our MPO decided very early on, back in the 90s when the ICE-T bill was passed, which created a lot of flexibility in transportation funding. And our MPO actually decided to take 10% of what were traditionally highway funds and set them aside for bike and pedestrian.
Wow. Lucky you.
Yeah, and that's now up to 15%. So even though there might be a little bit of a decline in what was mandated set aside for bike and pedestrian at the federal level and the state level, we're still maintaining that level locally. So we've still got, you know, decent amount of funds to get projects moving.
And what kind of projects are in the works right now in Orlando? Do I want to move down there?
Yeah, you may. We've got a really strong trail program here. We're very close to starting to pull together a really well interconnected regional trail network. And so, like a lot of areas, that's where we're putting a significant amount of our funds, bike and pedestrian funds, into that. But then also a lot of, you know, little projects that can make areas just more accessible, improve mobility for cyclists and pedestrians. Now, our area developed during the 70s, 80s, and 90s and developed on a much more suburban model. So it's inherently more problematic for cyclists and pedestrians to get around here because it's a very fragmented street network and very much oriented to high-speed arterials. So we're trying to retrofit that system to make it work better.
Well, you have the good fortune of being able to ride and walk around your area more months than we do. I mean, you know, certainly we have a very short window relative to Orlando. So that's kind of a good thing. So I also would like to talk about the way you're going about teaching. Don't you do some skills work, or is Cycling Savvy not part of Metroplan?
Well, Cycling Savvy is something that Metroplan supports, and you know, we host the classroom sessions of the course sometimes. And so we're, you know, like a lot of MPOs, we reach out to all sorts of community organizations to help, you know, promote our mission. So since safe cycling education is part of my program, then we were very much supportive of Cycling Savvy.
And so the question is, how did you choose Cycling Savvy over, say, the other organizations that offer skills and riding training?
Well, prior to Cycling Savvy, I was teaching the League of American Bicyclists courses, which used to be called Road One. Now it's Traffic Skills 101. And then I met Carrie Caffrey, and over the past few years, we decided that we had what we thought we needed to pull together something that we thought would work better from a traffic cycling education standpoint.
Right.
And so it's just that, you know, that's where I shifted my focus, both as a professional and just a person who wants better cycling education out there. And it's just been a nice natural progression. My boss took the course and really, really liked it, and he even promoted it to our board. We actually had one of our board chairmen take the course. So it's just gained a lot of support.
Which is a good thing. You know, Carrie and I are friends as well as colleagues, and I like the Cycling Savvy course too. I think it makes a lot of sense. So let's put your other hat on. So take off your Metroplan hat and put on your FBA hat, the
Florida Bicycle Association.
Association. Right. So you are the president. Now, how did that come about?
Oh, you know, nobody else wanted the job.
And your hand went up involuntarily, right?
No, I've been involved with the organization since its reinception. FBA was active back in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, kind of folded in the early 90s, and then came back to life in 1997. I've been involved with it some level or other since then.
And how many members does the Florida Bicycling Association have?
Not huge. Maybe about 1,500. It's always a challenge to get members. You know, a statewide organization has a challenge because we don't do things at the local level that are real tangible, you know, that people can point to. Our work tends to be a bit more abstract, harder for people to see a direct value to sometimes. But Cycling Savvy, I think, is definitely an exception to that, because people get to experience that course and realize a direct benefit in their lives.
So let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Mike Wilson. He is a couple of things. He's the president of the Florida Bicycling Association, and he also works with Metroplan Orlando as a planner. So let's talk about your conference. You sent me a survey, and you're planning a conference for February. Unfortunately, I can't attend because there's a conflict, but would you tell us about what you're planning to do with the conference, what it's all about, and about I Am Traffic, which I just think is the coolest name ever.
Great. It's actually called the I Am Traffic Colloquium, because it's not quite a conference. It's only 2 days long.
Okay.
First half of it is a bunch of presentations, but it's more than a meeting, too. So I had to look it up in the dictionary and figure out what that was. So what it's all about is trying to pull together all the best of cycling-related education and ultimately to create an organization from that. So I Am Traffic is more of a kind of a buzzword, a term to rally around. The organization will probably have a name that will be different from that, but I think it's a good phrase, a good theme. And what we'll be doing is on the first day, it'll be a number of presentations and from key bicycling educators, and that's really going to be the primary audience as well as the bicycling educators. We've got Roger DeBrito and Robert Seidler from Journeys from Home, and their focus is on elementary and middle school training. And Carrie Caffrey and I will talk about Cycling Savvy and kind of what the underlying principles of it are and how we see it moving forward in the future. Kirby Beck from the International Police Mountain Bike Association will be there to discuss strategies for connecting with law enforcement in a positive manner so they can understand some of the things that we're teaching to cyclists. We have Dan Gutierrez from California who will be coming in to outline his Understanding Bicycle Transportation course, which is for transportation professionals, traffic engineers, and planners. And then Dan's also going to spend some time talking about our 6 E's approach. So we have to look at equality, education, enforcement, engineering, encouragement, and evaluation.
Wow.
And the idea is that, you know, if you look at all those areas, and we think it's really important that you use the same set of principles throughout them. You can't have your education be in conflict with your engineering, for instance. That if we do that successfully, we're going to have a world in which cyclists are experiencing, you know, a safe and equitable road environment, and everybody would be much happier. I also should mention another person who will be there that he's not going to be presenting, but John Forrester, author of Effective Cycling.
Really? How nice.
And so, yeah, he's not presenting, but I'm sure he will make a significant contribution.
Yes, I think he will. So it sounds as if the colloquium is for basically bicycle professionals, but, and I understand you're trying to get all of these things sort of into a couple of days. What do you want to come out of the conference?
Well, hopefully we will leave with the beginnings of a new organization, and we'll have a clear idea of what our mission is going to be, what our governance and business models will look like, an understanding of how the new organization will relate to other organizations and the curricula that are coming from these other organizations. You know, some of them might become the curriculum of the new organization, or others might just have a working relationship. And then, of course, just a strategic plan for moving forward, you know, as a new organization. And, of course, a name, we'll need that, and a leadership board to move forward.
So is this strictly for Florida, or are you looking at this on a broader basis?
I don't know. This is intended to be a national organization.
Yes. Sounds awesome. Sounds awesome. That's great. So obviously the conference is open to whoever might want to attend, or the colloquium, sorry.
Absolutely.
You mentioned bicycling educators for elementary and middle school.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on, say, in Florida with getting more kids on bikes? That's always a big, I think there's a big stumbling block there, especially, you know, for these younger and middle school kids who are not active.
Well, Florida has had a program for many years, the Florida Traffic and Bicycle Safety Education Program, which is housed out of the University of Florida in Gainesville. And they have developed a curriculum and have had a program for many years to try to institute that curriculum in the schools, which mostly entails going to the teachers, mostly the PE teachers, training them to teach the curriculum, and then also working with the schools to show them how to set up the kind of equipment that they're going to need to make it a workable program. The challenge has always been that it's a fairly, you know, equipment and labor intensive effort, and schools are just always, they've got everybody coming to them saying, we want you to teach this and that and the other thing, and of course they need to be focusing on, you know, the 3 R's. But so it's just a real challenge to make things happen through the schools. It's just as much of a challenge to try to get that kind of training for kids out through other channels. And so I think it has to be kind of an all of the above approach.
So are there any SRTS programs, Safe Routes to School programs, that are incorporated into the – it's interesting that Florida even has a school program for cycling, but do they ever use any of the Safe Routes to Schools programs?
Well, sure. We use the Safe Routes to School funds, you know, both for, you know, building sidewalks, et cetera, and providing bike racks at schools, as well as the educational component of it. So, yeah, some school districts have used the Safe Routes to School funds to then implement their safety programs. You know, they can, for instance, get started with a trailer full of bikes and other equipment so that they can then run the curriculum.
Right. So let's talk again about the colloquium. When will it actually happen?
February 23rd and 24th.
And that is in Orlando?
Yes.
And how can people find out about it?
They can go to the commuteorlando.com website. We hope soon to have a website for iamtraffic.org. It's very close to launching. Gary and I and some others are still working on it. But in the meantime, they can go to commuteorlando.com. And if they scroll down the blog a little bit, they'll see the latest update for the event. And they can learn about, they can see the agenda there, and they can also register for the event.
Do you have bike shops involved?
We don't. There is one shop that would be involved more just from the standpoint of providing rental bikes because they're close into downtown. But at this point, bike shops aren't really on our radar, but it'll be part of the strategy in the long term for sure.
Yeah, I'm sort of seeing that, you know, some information disseminated out of the bike shop would get them involved going the other way, you know, that you know, having been in the bike shop for as many years as I have, that kind of made sense to me. So are people signing up?
Yeah, we've got a pretty good, so far we've got about 30 people signed up, and, you know, we've got another month to go, so hopefully we can maybe double that, so.
Well, I think it's awesome. I know you invited me, and again, I would love to have been there. I think this sounds like a great program. I'm anxious to see what comes out of it. Unfortunately, it's the same weekend as NABS. So I had already agreed to go to Denver. So I'd rather be in Orlando, frankly, in February than in Denver. But I wish you a lot of luck with this. I talk to Carrie a lot. So she will keep me informed, and after it's over, maybe we can talk again and see how it went and what's come out of it, if that's okay with you.
That would be great.
All right. Well, thanks for talking with me on the show this evening, Mike, and again, good luck with the I Am Traffic colloquium, and we will talk again.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Mike Wilson is associated with MetroPlan Orlando and the Florida Bike Association, and he joined us from Orlando, Florida.
Where it's probably warm and sunny, unlike here where it's sunny and cold.
I bet it's not sunny because, the days aren't that long yet, but it's probably warm.
Well, that's true this time of night.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I got it. I wish I could go to that conference. It sounds like it's going to really produce some interesting things. I hope that a national organization does come out of it and that it starts to coalesce some of these ideas. It's certainly got some big names coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So are we done?
Are we at the end of the hour?
I can't tell. My watch isn't working.
I believe we are, and that means
we better
pack it up and head out of here. But never fear, we'll be back with you next week for another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. And just a reminder, that's 1 week closer to WJCU's Radiothon 2013. And if you like what you hear on this station, or even if you listen to this as a podcast, please consider supporting us in mid-February as we raise most of the annual funding for WJCU as a radio station. So
that's true. We do not get paid for what we do, and the station graciously lets us produce this crazy show each week.
The station also doesn't get funding from the government or from the Catholic Church. A little bit of money from the university, but mostly it comes from you, the nice folks who listen to these programs every week. And so once a year we ask you for your help, and we'll be coming around, like I said, in mid-February to do that. So anyway, have a safe week. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.